Coming up next on 94.7 WTBC LP Charlottesville, it's Apropos of Something, co-hosted by Ellen Daniels and Nancy Lawrence. Apropos of Something welcomes experts, activists, and the marginalized from our community to discuss how the latest policies are affecting everyday people. Apropos of Something is brought to you by the Beckham team at Keller Williams. And now, here's Ellen.
Good morning, everyone. You're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, and I like to say Resistance Radio. We're also the Resistance station and show in Charlottesville. Apropos of Something airs live every Saturday morning from 10 to 11, co-hosted by me, Ellen Daniels, in our Charlottesville studio. Nancy Lawrence from our studio in New York City. We seek out the most interesting people we can find with a passion for social justice, political activism, and the arts. We guarantee every show will be apropos of something. Today, the brilliance is baked in. We speak to the fantastic baker-in-chief, Brian Noyes, whose life is as delicious as his baking. His Red Truck Bakery is one of 13 Condé Nast Traveler destination bakeries. We'll hear the tale of how President Obama came to love Brian's sweet potato bourbon pecan pie, and many highlights equally as fascinating as that. Hard to believe, but true. We also have on the show Adam Nemeth, award-winning writer. We're going to discuss his critically acclaimed debut novel, We Can Save Us All, a smart, sensitive, terrifying novel about masculinity, philosophy, technology, and the end of the world, says author Keith Gessen. And we'll talk about Jewish superheroes, also his music nonprofit, his film, and much more. Both of these gentlemen are multi-talented, as you heard. They are Virginia gems. But first, my gem of a friend, Nancy Lawrence, are you there?
Multi-talented? I am. No,
they are.
Listen, I want to say, I am here. I want to say, the weather in the New York office, which I rarely mention, I think befits both of our guests. I likened it to a confectioner's snow per Brian and the Lexington bourbon cake. Or I was thinking it's kind of a nuclear fallout, kind of end of the world weather here for Adam's new novel. So I thank them both for making this my intro. I crafted it specially due to the weather.
Thank you.
Anyway, yes. The important thing is I'm letting you say a word here, Elle.
No, that's fantastic. I like how you brought in, you know, into our guests their best qualities. I wanted to talk about, speaking of apocalypse, I've been made aware of Sarah Kendzior lately. She summed it up best, I think. She said, we've got a president backed up by a transnational crime syndicate masquerading as a government. And she was also calling to attention, you know, why didn't the press go after Manafort as soon as he was elected campaign chair instead of, you know, peddling or parading him onto the Sunday shows as if it was normal? And I think Maxine Waters was really on top of that. But anyway, and so she said, we've got this normalcy bias so that people think that if it was really bad, well, someone would do something. And then she said, this is what you get when you don't act in time.
Yeah, well, you know, to that I say, as I learned this week, thank God elections do matter, because we wouldn't be hearing half of the stuff we're hearing.
Wow, look at you.
The Democrats hadn't won the House.
Yes, look at you being all positive. That's fantastic. Switching roles.
The ones. And also, we learned that the Wharton Wonders SAT scores apparently are under audit, which
is that true?
Who knew? No, that's not true.
But apparently,
Michael Cohen has written countless cease and desist threatening letters, you know, to his school.
To the schools, yes.
Because this is another thing he has to keep secret from us.
Yes.
I know, cannot get numb. You are very correct.
So I also just want to mention a couple events. So our former guest, Jay Warr, is headlining Vibe Fest this Saturday, March 2nd, all genres of music at Ix Park. And then another guest that we've had on the show, the really amazing Tracy Howe, her album Things That Grow just dropped. And she really speaks about truth to power, justice, and music, of course. And if you've ever had the privilege of talking to her like we have on the show, you've really felt those words. And her album promotes racial justice, eco-justice, queer justice, and borderlands justice. She is headlining with the Reverend Siku and the National Freedom Fighters Monday, March 4th at The Haven.
It's a bunch of persistence.
I know, it is. So without further ado, I wanted to introduce our guest. Our first guest is Brian Noyce. Brian is the proprietor and baker-in-chief at the Red Truck Bakery with locations in Marshall and Warrington, Virginia. He's trained at the Culinary Institute of America and L'Académie de Cuisine. He started out as a newspaper man, became art director of the Washington Post and Smithsonian Magazine. In what appears to me, at least, is to be a very blessed life, he's had encounters with the likes of President Obama by way of his sweet potato bourbon pecan pie. He's rubbed elbows with Tommy Hilfiger and John Wayne and impressed many famous food critics. But I have the feeling from his 1921 Esso filling station bakery to his 1954 Ford truck, he's most home, at least these days, serving up homemade, from scratch, cakes, pies, donuts, muffins, croissants, pastries, granola, and more. His Red Truck Bakery cookbook, Gold Standard Recipes from America's Favorite Rural Bakeries, in its second printing, something very unprecedented in the cookbook world. Welcome to the show, Brian.
Well, thanks for having me in today. And Nancy, it sounds like you're really enjoying that Lexington bourbon cake.
What? No.
Well, yeah.
By the 8-ounce serving only. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I have to thank you for bringing that in. I dipped into it and we all shared a bit. We're going to post that on social media. The Lexington bourbon cake with fresh ginger. It came in a very handsome platinum tin. It's gorgeous. It has a generous amount of bourbon, I'm told. So if I'm a little tipsy today, that is why. No, just kidding. It's probably.
Yeah, you'll see the note that Dwight came up with to eat responsibly.
Yes, I did see that. It scared me. There's crystallized ginger, lemon, and my favorite ingredient, ghost peppers.
A little bit of that in the glaze with honey and more bourbon.
More bourbon, right. So, and a reviewer called your place a booze-heavy bakery with a drinking problem.
Yeah, we live by that.
So tell us about...
Maybe we shouldn't be using his last name.
Yeah, I know. I can't admit it. FCC rules forbid it. Tell us about your early career. I know you've had quite... an illustrious one as a 19-year-old newspaper art director. Tell us about that and an encounter with John Wayne.
Yeah, I was the young kid that was the first art director of a Southern California newspaper and the first time any newspaper was in color and in California. And after we ran a feature on John Wayne, I made an appointment with his housekeeper to return all the photos that we borrowed off his walls, and this teenager was carrying a very heavy carton, kicked on the front door, and she didn't answer, but he did with a big fat scowl and asked me, "You want a tuna sandwich?" And I had just eaten lunch, and I wasn't going to turn that down so that I could tell the story 40 years later.
How was the tuna sandwich?
It was good. We make it now. He smashes potato chips into it at the very end and turned to me and said, "And this is why you'll like this." So I had no choice.
The true grit is actually potato chips.
Gosh.
The deal.
Years later, you come up with the name of our sandwich.
Is that the name of it?
No, it should be.
It should be. What is it called now?
Tuna sandwich.
Oh, gosh. Sorry. Sorry to show you up, but Nancy's so good at that. Do you think you might really rename it?
Could be. I'd have to reprint the book.
Let us know. Yeah.
Well, what about, speaking of things from the past, how did your Uncle Stan bring you to where you are now?
Well, good segue. I was still there, Southern California, Newport Beach. He and my 11 cousins are in Florida, and he and I would do a cross-country bake-off. And he'd send something, I'd like it, and I'd send something back with the recipe. He'd send something back with my recipe all marked up in red ink, telling me why it might be a little bit better if I did something else. And eventually I moved to Tampa, became the art director of Tampa Magazine, and the cross-country bake-offs suddenly started taking place in his kitchen. And we worked on a really good harvest wheat bread. I named it after him. We serve it every day at both stores.
So then what happened sort of after that early, when you were 19 and you dealt with tuna sandwiches? How did it go from that to where you are now?
From Tampa, they sold the magazine. I rejoined the City Magazine Company in Detroit, then Houston, and ended up heading to Washington, D.C., and became the art director for Ben Bradley as he was launching a new Sunday magazine. So
And just tell people who he is.
He is the legendary and much missed, I was going to say a word I can't say, bravado behind the Washington Post and all its early fame.
And I believe you, well, I know that you named a coffee after him, or you dedicated it to him at least.
Yeah, I miss him. I miss working at the Post. I miss the days with Bradley. I also just miss the old days of newspapers, and there was a great term for the first edition that came out in the wee hours, and it was called the Bulldog Edition. And it's nobody uses that name anymore. I mean, there are no Bulldog Editions. And I wanted a big, robust, bold coffee, and I created it in honor of the biggest, baddest, boldest editor I knew. And have Ben Bradley's picture on it, but I call it the Bulldog Edition, which kind of sums him up, but also kind of tells what the coffee's all about at 6 a.m.
Brian, was it just coincidence that when you were an art director at the Post that you were close to all the food critics and doing like the Sunday magazine and all that food stuff? Was that just part of the job, or did you seek that angle out?
No, being the art director of the magazine, you know, I sat very close to the restaurant reviewer who wrote a column for the magazine. That was Phyllis Richmond. She retired. His assistant, by way of moves all over the country, came back to the Post and took over her job. But I learned a lot about food. Dwight and I would go out and kind of scout out restaurants that we were going to run in the Post, just so I can get an idea of what a dish might look like. And then I kind of became friends with some of the restaurateurs in D.C. And, I'm too far away from food.
So very impressive that your cookbook is in its second printing, the Red Truck Bakery Cookbook. So, and the Red Truck is everywhere. So it's on the cover. It's beautiful. And you started to sell items out of that truck. Tell us about how you got the truck and what happened around that.
Well, we got a farmhouse out in Fauquier County, about an hour west of D.C. for weekends. I would go out Friday nights, and I had this passion for baking. And I was the guy that always brought in baked goods for the staff meetings at the Post or Smithsonian or wherever. And so I pursued that. I pursued a CIA education, L'Académie de Cuisine outside of D.C. also taught me quite a bit. So on Friday nights out at the farmhouse, I'd bake, and I would deliver them, these baked goods, to a little country store nearby in the back of the red truck. And this is a truck, a 1954 Ford F-100 that I bought online from an unnamed seller who turned out to be Tommy Hilfiger, which just kind of adds to everything. But it's gorgeous, and people would line up at the store Saturday morning eventually, not waiting for the store to open as much as for the guy in the red truck and his red truck bakery baked goods to arrive. And then one of the people who enjoyed those at a picnic in Rappahannock County turned out to be a food writer for the New York Times named Marion Burroughs, who called me up the next week and asked if I wouldn't mind if she wrote a little piece for the Times about me. And I, of course, said, I wouldn't mind a bit. And it appeared in December. It was the front page of the food section, of kind of a roundup of where you can buy online foods, the best offers of online foods. I had a fledgling website. I was still at the Post, and I had 24 hits one morning. The next day when the story came out, I had 57,000 hits on the website. So I kind of knew I was on to something. That led to looking for space, and I found this old 1921 Esso service station in the county seat of Warrenton, and signed the lease and quit my job.
Thinking, what better to park outside of a 1921 Esso station than a 1954 Ford truck like the one you have? It's amazing.
It's pretty gorgeous.
And when you decided to take the stuff that you were doing in your own kitchen, the farmhouse, to like a brick and mortar space, how difficult was it to like translate all these recipes to large, huge quantities?
you know, 10 years later, I look back and think, boy, how naive was I? I mean, everything was kind of on the fly. I did no research. I didn't plan any of this out. I just kind of knew what I wanted to do. And, you know, I had a good kind of box full of good family recipes or just things that I liked. And that's, you know, I always make sure what we're making and selling is something I like. And we try not to do fussy things, but just, you know, good, hearty, fun stuff. And, you know, you just double or triple. And then if suddenly you're sold out, then you quadruple or, you know, make more and more. But it's the easy part was making big batches of these things. The hardest part was 10 years later, knuckling down and having to back up and take all these big chunky recipes and whittle them back down to a home cook size. And that was a kind of a whole crazy exercise.
So there's this picture of President Obama eating one of your pies, the sweet potato bourbon pecan pie. Tell us that story.
Okay, here I go.
there tuna fish involved?
No, none at all.
Okay. Potato chips?
Other treasures. Yeah. You know, we signed the lease on the old gas station. I quit my job. Dwight's an architect. We kind of gave it a kind of rural Virginia vernacular inside. It's pretty sweet. And then the Great Recession hit. And, you know, I had hired a few staff members. We had a bunch of farmers that were going to start growing some things for us. We're a seasonal bakery. You don't get a cherry pie in the middle of December, but, you know, cherry pie season in late June, July, we'll have cherries. So these were farmers I built relationships with. Recession hit. Sleepless nights, worried about making payroll, paying everybody. And Obama was just coming into office. And, you know, I had to put my faith behind this new team. And we did. We survived. We eventually got to 2 stores and almost 50 employees. We shipped thousands of things nationwide, which was the reason for the move to the bigger store. We just couldn't handle it. I had to keep kicking the bakers off their baking tables so that we could box things up before the UPS guy arrived. And so that first year, that first Christmas in the new store, running 2 locations, shipping thousands of things, January hit. I just looked back and thought, what was all that about? And it was the craziest year for us, and the response was incredible. So I sat down and I wrote a note to Obama just to recap everything I just said to you and mailed it. And, you know, I know he gets, you know, 10 or 20 or 40,000 letters a day. And I know that they picked 9 to go on his desk. And a month later, I was off. My store manager called and said, there's a guy here with an envelope from the White House. And I said, well, just put it on my desk and I'll see you tomorrow. And so I came in the next day and I read the note, and indeed was. And I got an email right around then from Cody Keenan, who's Obama's chief speechwriter. And he said, I'm the guy that dropped that off. We don't normally deliver handwritten correspondence from the president, but I did that for 3 reasons. 1, the president likes your story. 2, the president loves pie, and I'm on my way to the Inn at Little Washington with my fiance for Valentine's Day. And dropped it off and picked up a pie for the president and a moonshine cake for my staff. And so I wrote back. I said, that's great. What kind of pie did you get? He said, a pecan pie. I said, well, the pie you should have gotten in front of the president is our sweet potato bourbon pecan pie. And he emailed back just a minute, and then next came an email with 3 words, POTUS says yes. So
wow.
The rest of the day I was making a couple of those pies, and we had set up a delivery spot and took them to him. And in the next month, on 3.14, March 14th, Pi Day, at 3:14 p.m., when a presidential administration had a sense of humor, they released a whole salute to our bakery, our story, and our pies. And
that's incredible.
We've taken care of one another since then.
That is incredible. Thanks for that story. We're speaking with Brian Noyes. We're going to talk more with him. We're going to hear more about pies and where you can meet him We'll let you know about that after this break. Stay with us. And we're also going to speak with Adam Nemeth, award-winning writer. Stay with us. Welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Apropos of Something. We air every Saturday from 10 to 11. This is 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. We have the pleasure of speaking with Brian Noyes today. Brian, so tell us where we've been, you know, I feel like the mouths are watering, and mine sure has been this morning with that bourbon cake. Where can we get your cakes? Where are you speaking? And tell us about, your locations.
Well, that's the best place to get it is at our two stores, one in Warrenton, one in Marshall, right up 29 from here. We ship nationwide. Our website shows the more sturdy cakes that survive UPS manhandling. Our fruit pies don't, so we encourage you getting those in our stores. We do ship a pecan pie and a pecan pie with bourbon and chocolate, and our mincemeat pie because they're sturdy, but otherwise it's full of cakes. No fussy layer cakes, but some substantial bourbon, amaretto rum cakes. If it's got booze, we're eating it.
You're all over it. Do you pair that with an alcoholic beverage?
Well, we don't have a liquor license, funny enough, but we're not shy about telling you what might go with something.
Okay.
Starting with us, because I'd like to go wherever that cake goes.
So, and you generously brought a salted caramel apple pie today, which I can't wait to dig into.
Well, I sent you some things ahead of time. Mm-hmm. I wanted you to try the pie, which we don't ship for the reasons I mentioned. But I like hand delivering that as a kind of business card.
And I wanted to mention that a lot of the proceeds go to, or some of them, you really care about nonprofits. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Every May there's a Give Local Piedmont program, and we always pick one nonprofit that we'll throw our weight behind. A couple of years ago, when the new administration was yanking national park funding, we threw our weight behind the National Park Service Foundation. There's a couple other fundraisers or nonprofits that we like to do a lot of fundraising for. I took a couple weeks off from the bakery and helped make sandwiches with Jose Andres at his Chefs for Feds program downtown during the furlough, and never had any idea that we'd make 88,000 sandwiches in just those few days.
Wow.
And, I'd love to help them out as much as I can.
And in terms of the book, the cookbook, how difficult was it for you to decide what goes in and what does not?
Well, the beauty of having a really incredible publisher, Clarkson Potter and Penguin Random House, is they got it down. And, you know, I figured they had a horrible client because I'm a magazine art director and I was going to be insistent upon the way things looked. But as soon as I met the art director, I knew that, you know, he had as great a sense of our type as I did, and it was in good hands. We made our list of what we wanted in. It got organized by categories like pies, cakes, biscuits. That's a big thing for us now. And we came up with a big list, and the big list got chopped some. Some of the categories needed more, so it's up to them to push us to get what they wanted in the book. They hired the best food photographer in the country, Andrew Thomas Lee, and I think it's just gorgeous.
So between the Esso station, filling station, and the red truck, the 1954 truck, there's a lot of charm in this rural bakery. What is the experience you're trying to create for your customers?
Well, I want to create a destination. There's so many people that come, fall in love with us, and want us to open up a red truck at some new development in D.C. or in Fairfax or Richmond or, you know, New Orleans. I mean, I hear every place, but it's all about designing just a kind of rural destination. And from the first days when we were just the smallest part of a Southern Living story about antiquing in the Piedmont and were listed as one of the food places in the end of the story, people would show up with that magazine in their hands, and they're driving from Charlotte to Boston or somewhere up 95 and would veer off to see this little rural bakery. So it's, you know, it's all about creating just a unique destination, charming place, and not being in a strip center next to a nail salon.
You know, Ellen did, you know, mention that you have the second location in Marshall, but I don't want to pass over the fact that the person that helped cut the ribbon for that that bakery was also significant. How did that happen?
Well, he's one of our oldest, most fun customers, and by oldest I mean longest customer. But the actor Robert Duvall lives nearby, and he would come in, he'd sit around, he'd schmooze. I caught on that if you want to talk to him, you don't talk about movies, but you talk about meat. And he loves barbecue and he loves steak. So if you start off with that, you'll never leave. He also likes kids. So if little kids come in, I've seen him get up and walk out. And then somebody came in with some kids and he would sit down and talk to them. And it's been the sweetest little thing. So I asked him if he'd do a ribbon cutting for our new store up in Marshall near his farm. He doesn't cut ribbons, but I got him a farm rope, and he sawed through that with a pocket knife, which I lifted right out of his hand and told him he's not getting that back, and it's now hanging up with a piece of the rope and his signature on our walls. But he has showed up with James Caan, who has always been this hero of mine from when I was a kid. I mean, that just blew me away. And they were eating lunch, and they were eating tuna sandwiches, so I could tell them my John Wayne story, which was a big hit for them.
So you really attract, besides famous people, just a lot of success. What do you think is the reason for that in your life?
Well, we have good food. I mean, that's primary thing. But, you know, and we've got a great staff, and it's very warm, it's very friendly. Dwight's architecture is very welcoming. You know, one person I do need to mention is Charlottesville, former Charlottesville resident, and that's Mary Chapin Carpenter, who was a regular at our Warrenton store and kind of followed us up to the new Marshall store. And she would sit at the window on a counter stool, and she would work on her album. And her dogs were parked out front in the back of her truck. And it was, you know, it's just a sweet place for anybody to show up and do anything. And it's, you know, it's we love everybody coming in. We try to keep everybody happy. We listen to customer comments and wishes for new items, and even some of them we pursue.
I think you've been answering the question that I just asked this whole interview. You know, it seems that it's authenticity and quality and amazing food and a great heart, I would say.
I think the biggest draw that probably sparks everything is a little red truck cookie that we make every day. We always have them there, and it's what brings in the kids, and they come back again and again with mom and dad, and that's what they want. So it's always there. It's sweet, and you know, once you hook the kids, you got everybody.
So it's not your heart, it's not your talent, it's just the cookie.
Yeah,
it's sweet
too. It's what comes out of the oven.
I am gonna ask. I know that you're. You know, your what you offer is derived by like the what's available during the season. So maybe this question doesn't work. But because things are only available when they're available, do you find you have popular items? Do people's favorites, you know, register or not?
Well, right now we have a Meyer lemon cake, which I always think is kind of a summery a late winter, spring, summery kind of thing. As soon as we're out of December, I am done with heavy fall foods, and I think I think a lot of customers agree that it's nice to get a little hit of sunshine with the Meyer lemon cake, and that goes on to the end of August, and then we come up with our heavier Shenandoah apple cake with a maple glaze. We're right on the edge of the Shenandoah Valley. We're in apple country. And that lasts till the end of the year. And, of course, once one of those cakes goes out of season and the other one comes in, they're either pining for the old one or they're anticipating the new one. And so we try to keep up with what they like, and hopefully we have.
What is a peach?
Oh, sorry.
What's a peach milkshake, pie, or cake?
Cake. Is that it?
What is it?
Yeah.
It's a new concoction. We started playing with that right before we started working on the cookbook. And it's a little kind of frothy, light, summery kind of bite of peaches and a cake. I mean,
yum. Yum.
Do you reveal what? How many secrets are revealed in this cookbook?
All of them. I held nothing back. I fell in love with Loveless Cafe in Nashville and their biscuits. And they had a cookbook. I went in there. The biscuit recipe's in there. I bought it. I took it home, read the recipe, and it says, of course we wouldn't tell you how we make our famous biscuits, but you might like this recipe, which just really infuriated me. And I thought, you know, I'm doing a cookbook now, and I'm going to tell everybody exactly what they want. And our granola has a life of its own. We send thousands of those every year. Andrew Zimmern called it the best granola in North America, and people were just blown away that that recipe is in the cookbook. But, I mean, you're buying into our secrets, and, you know, I held nothing back.
It is delicious. You did send me that, and I just kept eating it night after night.
I think that's right. Me as well, whatever. I was thinking interaction between the Congresswoman Spear and Michael Cohen when she asks, you know, how many times did you threaten an individual? Well, this is similar. If you were to ask me how many times have you been thinking about that chunky and hearty granola, I would say quite a few times more, 50 times more, 100 times more. Yeah,
yeah, over 500.
Yeah.
Over 500, so. Yeah.
Totally applies to you.
Well, it's when you open it, it's like it looks like homemade. I mean, it looks super homemade. It's not like the kind you buy in the grocery store at all, and it tastes like it.
Well, I did not want it tasting like it came from a natural foods organic market owned by a guy who owns the Washington Post. I didn't want it to taste cardboardy. I really wanted it to taste, you know, homey, and I think it does.
It does, yeah.
So where can people, where are you, I mean, we can't keep you here much longer. So where can people hear you and see what you're up to for themselves? Where are you next?
Lucky for you, the Virginia Festival of the Book kicks off in just a couple of weeks. And on Thursday, March 21st, we'll be doing a baking demo at Williams-Sonoma here in Charlottesville. And I will be at least making buttermilk biscuits, and which is right in the cookbook. And we'll also, I never travel anywhere without our Lexington bourbon cake, and we'll have some Meyer lemon cake and our amaretto almond cake gluten-free samples for everybody. So that'll be on the 21st. Hopefully that morning I'll also get by New Dominion Bookstore in the downtown mall, and I'll be packing cake and a pen to sign cookbooks.
Very good. Well, thank you so much for being here, Brian Noyce, the fantastic...
Thanks for sending us all that stuff.
The fantastic baker-in-chief of Red Truck Bakery. Thank you so much.
You bet. Nancy, wipe your mouth.
Yes! Okay, I will.
You're so familiar with
the... How can you tell? This New York office isn't as far away as I thought it was, I guess. I don't know.
So up soon will be Adam Nemeth, the award-winning writer. Very excited to talk to him. But before that, Nancy, do you have a news of note today?
I do, and I am trying now to segue to our next guest. I'm speaking of, because I will be speaking of climate change, meaning that the Senate last week just confirmed a former coal, chemical, and uranium lobbyist, Andrew Wheeler, to lead the federal agency tasked with protecting our health and environment. It's perfect irony. It's classic Trump, mostly along party lines. But anyway, Wheeler's been there since Pruitt left in July, and he's doing essentially the same stuff, same horrible stuff, minus the secure phone booth request and, you know, fetching Ritz-Carlton moisturizer, having his interns do that. But anyway, he has yet to have, remember when that 13 government agency assessment came out that global warming is causing damage, including to the economy. He got confirmed anyway, but he just sat there and said he's still not yet formed an opinion on it. You know, it came out in November. Anyway, it's him. He's my news of note.
Yes. Well, thank you for that. Good segue. Our next guest is Adam Nemeth. He is an award-winning writer, as I have mentioned. His debut novel, is We Can Save Us All. It has received really great reviews in a lot of publications, including the New York Times Book Review and the Los Angeles Review of Books. And he's made it, the book's made it to the top book lists, a lot of book lists, such as Britain Co. Book Club's Three New Books That Are So Punk and Post-Punk It Hurts. He's a frequent contributor to magazines and newspapers such as Variety, The New Yorker, Washington Post, The Brooklyn Rail, and many more. He's a creative director also of At History Factory, where he's been honored for his writing. He founded MEMA, a music education nonprofit for youth, and he wrote and directed a film called The Instrument. Well, welcome to the show, Adam.
Thanks so much for having me.
You are a bit of a Renaissance person.
Or I can't focus, one or the other.
But you do it all so well. You focused on this book because I heard it took you 12 years to write it.
I did focus on this book, yeah. It took about 12 years and finally dragged it across the finish line and really happy to be able to hold it in my hand.
Is it hard to describe or is it just me? It's got everything in it, climate change, campus, sexual assault, religion, modern day social heroes, higher education.
Yeah, I guess after 12 years, I sort of threw a lot in here, and hopefully, I don't mind being a little messy. I'm a maximalist. My father is a painter. He's probably listening right now, so hi, Dad. And he is something of a maximalist as well. He's very additive in his process, and so that sort of combination of different things and a little messiness doesn't scare me, but I'm happy to describe the book in as succinct a way as possible if that's helpful.
Yeah,
we dare you. Yeah. Yes, please go. I don't know. It's close to a commercial.
Let's go to a break and then what's our appetite? We'll be right back with Adam Nemet when we come back. Much more. Welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Apropos of Something. We air every Saturday morning from 10 to 11. I wanted to mention something I didn't mention before. We are going to be giving away Randy Rainbow tickets at some point during the show in the next couple of weeks, so please stay tuned. I think you heard the promo. He was in the room when he did it. That's what I'm going to say. So we're back with Adam Nemet. You were about to describe your book.
Sure. It's literary fiction. It's called We Can Save Us All. It's about a bunch of Ivy League students at Princeton University during the escalating days of climate change. They decide that their typical kind of class curriculum doesn't have as much value as it used to, and so they move off campus into a geodesic dome and start what becomes kind of an end times cult. Based on superheroes and fueled by psychedelic drugs and performance enhancers.
You know, I know, obviously, as Ellen just said, it took you the... I don't mean anything by this. Because it took you the time it took you, do you ever think now that it is now that it's published, how different it might have... You know, it's so timely, accidentally, apparently, but do you ever wonder... What if I had a 2-week binge and done this in whatever minus 12 years ago was instead? You know, do you ever think about how appropriate it is, kind of?
You know, I was I started writing this at grad school in San Francisco, California College of the Arts, which was an amazing school, an amazing program. I loved it. And I was taking a class with Leslie Carroll Roberts, who's now the head of the program. It was about climate change. It was called An Inconvenient Art, and it was shortly after Al Gore's movie came out. So I was learning a lot about climate change, at least in the way that we thought about it, a decade or 12, 13 years ago at the time. And that was really fascinating to me and inspiring. Maybe it was a little bit, ahead of the curve in terms of the national conversation. But, back then it seemed just as necessary and timely as it is now. Unfortunately, we haven't maybe made a whole lot of progress against that in the intervening decade.
So in your book, you describe, I think you probably made this up, chronostrictesis.
Sure. We've gone back and forth on the pronunciation. I've been going chronostrictesis, sort of like photosynthesis. But
okay.
Yeah, it's another sort of phenomenon layered onto the end times literal ticking clock of the book, which is the shortening of time, the feeling, kind of qualitative feeling that time is running out all the time, and that, you know, in a measurable scientific way, each day has fewer and fewer minutes. And I try, you know, I played with earlier drafts of kind of getting deeper into the science and what might be legitimately causing this. And I pulled some of that back over the course of the years from, you know, different feedback I got. I think some of it is just sort of the feeling of growing up and having kids and, you know, taking on more responsibility in your life, that feeling that, that there's less and less time every day. It's just sort of what it feels like for me, and I think for a lot of people. But that's another element that's sort of layered into the book, that feeling of time shortening.
Yeah, I thought that in terms of sci-fi elements, I really liked how you did that. That you thought to make time as much of a factor in everything instead of just, I don't know, instead of ignoring it, I guess, in all of this rush to the impending doom to screw around with that. And in terms of your connection to superheroes, since that is also an aspect of this, what is your connection to superheroes?
Sure. You know, I was never a huge comic book guy growing up, but I always loved superheroes, and I think I actually thought I was a superhero for like the first 3 or 4 years of my life. I wore a Superman cape to the grocery store and just around. I would, you know, push my finger into the little spot above the bridge of my nose, the way Clark Kent would all the time, to sort of push his glasses up. And you know, a bunch of other weird tics like that. And I think I always have, been excited about the idea of superheroes, not just for the costuming or the capes or the actual powers itself, but the feeling of watching, a character go from normal to extraordinary, that origin story. Last week, you know, you were talking about the Oscars on your show, and you were talking about Black Panther and the origin story there, and watching someone kind of come into their power. I think there's a lot of, you know, A Star Is Born is as much that kind of story as anything, you know, watching this sort of very normal but very talented person kind of come into their power and become extraordinary. So that's what fascinates me about superheroes, and the idea that it's not just in my book, it's not just, you know, a single or even a small group of actual alien mutant power type superheroes. It's more of this large movement of students, everyone, hundreds and hundreds of students on this college campus, that then spreads to other campuses nationwide. The idea that everyone is finding whatever it is that's special about them and coming into that power and owning it and kind of elevating it in an interesting way, where we can all play a very active role in saving the world, as opposed to you know, waiting for someone else to swoop in literally and do it.
So that segues to something I wanted to ask you. You wrote a great piece in a column for the Jewish Book Review, and the column is called The Pros and People, which is so genius, and it's on Jewish superheroes. So, and you talk in that article about why Jewish writers are so often called to this genre, and you cite the Old Testament and more contemporary writers, I think, in my very non-literary way, of Jerry Seinfeld and his fascination with Superman. And you also wrote a piece, Was My Grandfather Batman, in Salon. Can you speak to some of that?
Sure. I guess the origin story of that was, as the book was coming out, my publisher, The Unnamed Press, they're based in L.A., and they're about 5 years old and done about 60 books. They suggested that I write a few personal essays that would come out around the same time as the book to help with the marketing. And my publisher said, you know, what about writing something about, you know, Jewishness and superheroes? You know, is there any connection there? And I said, well, you know, sure. Most of the superhero creators happen to be Jewish. You know, most of the creators of the superheroes we know and love, from Siegel and Schuster with Superman to Bob Kane and Bill Finger with Batman, Stan Lee, Jack Kirby, you know, on and on and on. It just so happens that most of the Marvel and DC universe were created by Jews. And so why is that? And I started doing a little research into that part of the story. And in the process of doing that research, I realized that my grandfather, Bob Kane and Bill Finger, the two co-creators of Batman, as well as Stan Lee, all graduated from the same high school in the Bronx, DeWitt Clinton High School. And that was the high school that my grandfather graduated from, and he graduated the same year as Kane and Finger. And my grandfather was orphaned in freshman year of high school. His father had already died, but then his mother was murdered, and it made, you know, the New York Times and Brooklyn Eagle and a lot of the newspapers at the time. Remains unsolved. But I kind of went down that path of wondering whether he was sort of the inspiration for Kane and Finger coming up with the Bruce Wayne character and the, you know, tragedy that befalls him. And I don't know that I have a definitive answer on that, but he lived about a block away from each of them as this was happening. And it's sort of a fascinating, frightening story. But kind of went down that rabbit hole of research a bit and ended up in Ceylon.
I was actually wondering, in terms of the research for this book, how much, what did you decide to tackle versus just create, you know, from your own?
Sure. I think over the course of 12 years, so much that I read and watched and experienced kind of came down to help in researching this book. It was a lot of fiction I was reading, of course, but then a lot of nonfiction as well. More content about climate change. I got sort of deep into student movements, you know, campus protest around the 60s and 70s. A great book by Clara Bingham called Witness to the Revolution. I got a great book by Rebecca Solnit called Paradise Built in Hell, where it talks about, you know, the different improvisational mutual aid societies and communities that end up developing around times of disaster. Stretching from the 1906 San Francisco earthquake up through Hurricane Katrina, what we see on the news is often the chaos or the looting or some of these things that are usually ascribed to black and brown people only and shown in such a unfortunate way, when in reality these communities that are affected by these disasters typically band together in a really beautiful way and help each other and find these sort of makeshift systems to get through it. So that was a lot of what I was trying to get across in the book. And mainly it's climate change in the book and somewhat mundane climate change. It'll just be a lot of rain or, you know, a storm of some kind where the power goes off for 2-3 weeks. And it was an interesting thought experiment to figure out, you know, how we would adapt to that or what we would do to, you know, maintain our sanity and our humanity, in simple situations that we're just not used to, like the power being off for a little while.
So you also directed, I believe you directed and wrote a film, The Instrument. What is that film about?
It's another sort of ensemble piece. It came out in 2005. It's called The Instrument, and it's about a group of students, again, at a college who their mentor dies and leaves behind the blueprints for a new system of ritual worship based on music. And so they have to live in this warehouse, this very interactive musical warehouse for a month, and they go through these seven different musical rituals in order to kind of unlock these boxes and gain this inheritance. But there's a lot of costume, there's a lot of music, there's a lot of dance. I didn't really know what I was doing going into this process. I hadn't even made a short film, but I loved music. I've always loved music, and it ended up becoming this movie where everyone kind of collectively worked together, worked for free. My family was all involved in one way or another, and everyone was living at my house, about 20 or 30 members of the cast and crew, and somehow we got through it.
You know, this love of music you have mentioned, I'm going to set this up so easily, but does any of your love of music have anything to do with this MIMA music project that you started?
Well, it's funny you ask.
Isn't it, though?
So in college, a few of us got together and started a you know, at the time, just a student organization called MIMA, which stood for Modern Improvisational Music Appreciation at the time. And that was a fancy name for the to get the school to pay for us to throw parties. And it was a lot of fun. We threw a ton of parties. We ultimately had about 500 or 600 members. And I think a lot of that actually factored into the inspiration for my novel. There was nothing cultish about it, about the actual MIMA organization. But something about kind of watching this thing go from nothing to something on campus and kind of take off and gather lots of people together for these fun, crazy experiences. So it started in that way, just at Princeton. And then, over the course of the years really took off. I handed it off to, I don't take the credit for it its growth. But it became a 501c3 nonprofit, under the leadership of some other folks, became funded by the State Department. We've been to about 40 countries now, providing, free music education, a very innovative, a collaborative songwriting program that we've developed over the course of about 15, 16 years. Actually, we're about to turn 20 now. And we started a new chapter in Charlottesville a couple of years ago. We're in a lot of schools around here. Have about 15 or 20 programs across Central Virginia. Check it out at mimamusic.org.
And also your website, adamnemett.com. That's Adam, NEMETT.com. We can get the book anywhere, and I'm sure you can be directed. Actually, it's a great website. There's
Thanks.
A lot of stuff on there, all about your work. And where are you going to be? Where can people hear you talk about your book?
Sure. Well, you know, I will be, you know, battling out with Brian, at the Virginia Festival of the Book. Also, event on Thursday morning at 10 a.m. at the library. I'll be moderating a panel on Friday. Yeah, 10 a.m. on Thursday, Virginia Festival of the Book. And then I'll be doing a little West Coast tour. I'm going to AWP conference in Portland, going to, San Francisco to City Lights Books, which is kind of a bucket list moment for me, going to LA to Skylight Books. And that'll be the first week in April, and then headed back to LA the week after for the LA Times Book Festival.
Wow.
Per your book, we can save us all, Adam. In your view, can humanity save humanity?
I think we have to, right? No one else is going to do it. I think, you know, being that we're in Charlottesville right now, I think I'll share a sad but sort of hopeful final note here that my daughter Rose was born, who's listening. Hi, Rose. And my son Jack is listening now too. Hi, Jack. My daughter was born about 11 days before August 12th, and all of that happened, and it was very scary. But what was exciting was, in some way, was that it wasn't, you know, a singular hero that came in to help. It wasn't the mayor. It wasn't the police. It was really, you know, the members of this community, especially, you know, LGBT community, people of color, women. Those were the people on the front lines that I saw, clergy, seeing, you know, just members of the community all step up and band together, to kind of expel that evil was, somewhat hopeful.
Well, thank you so much for being here, Adam Nemett. It was great to learn about you. I can't wait to peruse a little bit more about Jewish superheroes on your website and many, many other topics. Thanks for being here.
Yeah,
thank you.
Your book is also, as you know, an audiobook,
yes.
And this voice is reading the whole book, which is quite incredible.
Yeah, if you can stand listening to this voice and want more of it, check it out on Audible or any of the places you buy audiobooks.
It's a great voice.
You perhaps have superhero in your genes. I think, you know, it's just as well you're the narrator, actually.
Well, thank you.
And yeah. The other superhero, Brian Noyce, thank you also for being here. I cannot wait to go visit. I'm so lucky that I'm close enough, about 30 minutes from Charlottesville or a little bit more for the other location, under an hour, to get some pie. I will be there.
We're waiting for you.
They're waiting for you. Okay, cool. So, Nancy, do you have a palate cleanser? We have time.
I do, is the short answer.
Okay, go. I'm not ready for that. Yeah, okay. It's
no?
queuing up.
Is it too technical?
No, it's queuing.
Ah, well.
Okay, the palate cleanser.
Don't want to rush that music. Okay, thank you. Speaking of things that are printed, there's a Berlin art collective, and excuse my French here, but it's called Rob Druckerin. It translates to pirate printing, and they want to capture, what they do is they capture the unique footprint of countless European cities, and they turn those footprints into wearable art. This was like manhole covers and street tiles, utility grates, signage, anything affixed to the street, and they use all that stuff as a printing press. So they roll ink directly onto these surfaces, just as you can imagine, like, you know, with those ink things. And then they apply fabric to it, and they do it. It becomes, at that moment, it's like street or flash mob pop art, whatever. And then, you know, because they're from Berlin, they always clean up. And but they have these. They make these guerrilla souvenirs from all these cities, like tote bags and T-shirts and backpacks, and they sell them all on their website. And I know, of course, I'm not going to spell this German word out again, but if it's of interest to you, even just to watch what it is they do, not that you want to get a Copenhagen tote or anything, but anyway, just Google Pirate Printers Berlin, and you'll find this word, Rob Druckerin. It's very cool.
Thanks. I'm glad we got that in. Thank you so much to our guests. Our theme music is by Springtide. Here's a little bit of it. Remember, we're going to be giving out Randy Rainbow tickets in the next couple of weeks, so stay tuned. Remember, no one has to do everything, but everyone has to do something. See you next week. Thank you so much, Nancy.
Yeah, great.
Okay, bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to Apropos of Something this morning on 94.7 WPBC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Show and host Ellen Daniels and Nancy Lawrence each Saturday at 10 for Apropos of Something. Brought to you by the Beckham team at Keller Williams. Show archive can be found at SeavillePodcast.com.